This episode is brought to you by FinditNWA.com, your hyper-local business directory connecting you with the best of Northwest Arkansas. Whether you're looking for a new place to eat, a trusted service provider, or unique local shops, FinditNWA has you covered. We also highlight businesses with a featured listing on the site. That means if you're a small business owner in NWA, you could be next. Discover more at FinditNWA.com.
It's time for another episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas, the podcast covering the intersection of business, culture, entrepreneurship, and life in general here in the Ozarks. Whether you are considering a move to this area or trying to learn more about the place you call home, we've got something special for you. Here's our host, Randy Wilburn.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to another episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn, and I'm excited to be with you as always. I am sitting here in the Furman Garner Performance Studio here at KUAF 91.3 FM. It is the local NPR affiliate. If you don't listen to public radio, you need to tune in to KUAF. I always like to give them a shout out because they have given me a home. Now, I have a home. I have a place to record. I've recorded at the library. I record sometimes at different locations throughout Northwest Arkansas. But the folks at KUAF, probably more than 18 months ago at the time of recording this, opened their doors to me and said, hey, we'd love for you to be a part of what we're doing here. And so it's just been a nice marriage. I have my independence because I can talk to whomever I want to talk to about whatever I want to talk to. So I really appreciate that. And the simple fact that they have all the facilities, so I literally can walk into an amazing studio and flip on the lights and, set record and go for it. But I'm really excited about today's episode because I have a chance to connect with an individual that I didn't know. And this whole conversation is happening because of one individual, and I call her my personal connector. Her name is Karen Wagaman. Karen is with the Rogers Lowell Chamber of Commerce, and I want to give her just a quick shout out. I want to give the Rogers Lowell Chamber of Commerce a shout out. I think it's probably the best Chamber of Commerce in all of Northwest Arkansas for the work that they do. All the Chamber of Commerces are good here in Northwest Arkansas, but Rogers Lowell is just kind of just a little extra special, and Karen is a whole lot of that secret sauce over there. But she called me one day and said, hey, Randy, I've got somebody that I think you should meet. His name is Aaron Mankin, and Aaron is a veteran of the Iraqi War, and he has an amazing story. And she was very resolute with that, and she didn't go into detail, but she said, listen, you guys need to connect. And I reached out to his dad, Steve, and we had a conversation, and then Aaron and I got on the phone and had a conversation, and I was like, wow, this would be great, because I've always wanted to do an episode for Veterans Day. And so this is giving me an opportunity to tell an important story that people need to hear. And so without further ado, I want to welcome Aaron Mankin to the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hi. Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, happy to be anywhere, honestly. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. And listen, every day I wake up is a good day. So that's the way it goes. So listen, Aaron, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, about your origin story? I know you started... You grew up and you still live in Rogers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. So share a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I think I had a pretty typical childhood growing up. I happy kid, played out in the streets and, didn't come home until the lights came on and, play basketball, sports, football, soccer, baseball, whatever we could throw a game together, get enough kids to do, riding bikes, building ramps, playing war, drinking out of water hoses, pretty typical childhood. Did well in school, understood, assignments and what was expected of me and how to meet expectations. Did well with grades, and it wasn't until I was in high school and joined the debate team that I found once I learned that they'd give me trophies and awards and scholarships for saying words, I thought, that's in my wheelhouse. That's something I can do. So I enjoyed doing that. We won state our first year, my partner, Jay Scott, and I, and then we qualified for nationals our second year and really started that debate program on the trajectory, you know, upwards. It was that was a great time. Yeah, graduated with honors and went into a community college, Northwest Arkansas Community College, for a few years, just basic general education. Graduated in 2000 from high school, from Rogers High School. And, you know, after 9/11, felt like the world changed and my generation was going off to war. And I didn't think that was something I could sit out and not participate in. You know, that's how it felt at the time.
So you felt really called to serve the country, your country, our country, in that capacity that happened.
This was 2003. The onset of Operation Iraqi Freedom. It wasn't the Iraq War yet. It was just, you know, we were going, it seemed like a righteous thing from what we were sold at the time and what we were being told from leadership, that, you know, weapons of mass destruction and dethroning a dictator and bringing democracy to the people. It was something that if I was who I thought I was growing up, or who I wanted to be growing older, then this was something I needed to be a part of.
Yeah. So you decided to become a Marine. How did you choose the Marine Corps over all the others?
That's a great question, because I did my research. I thought, you know, I'm going to talk to every branch of the military, and I wanted to do something for the military that I thought I could do well, something that I, you know, a skill set that I could bring to the table instead of just being another pair of boots in the sand.
Yeah.
So when I found position as a combat correspondent, or that I could be a journalist in the military, I thought, okay, that speaks to me. My dad had given me a camera when I was 14 or 15, and I started shooting film, got into some state media festivals and did well and placed a lot. And dad always telling me, you got an eye for it.
Yeah.
And so,
well, I mean, as an aside, I will say this, that before we started recording this episode, I had just finished up a podcast interview with another guest, and Aaron offered to take a picture, because I always take a picture of my podcast guest in front of the KUAAF sign. And I noticed right off the bat that Aaron wasn't a normal picture taker. He has an eye for detail, and he took the picture from multiple angles. I can only imagine, and I can only say that this picture is probably going to be one of the better pictures that I've taken, or I've had taken, of me and a guest here at KUAF. So I appreciate
you,
that.
But of course, but, you know, if I'm not getting shot at, I can take a decent photo.
There you go.
Even then, actually, even still, yeah.
Okay, so, and I think it's important that we mention that, you know, there are all kinds of opportunities within the military, right? People think, oh, well, they think infantry, right? They think, oh, I'm going to be on the front lines. And it's like, no, there's a little bit of everything. I mean, I mentioned to you before that I've always tried to celebrate Veterans Day for my grandfather, because he received multiple Purple Hearts in World War II. And he was an engineer.
Yeah.
He was a civil engineer that knew how to blow up bridges. He could build a bridge, but he could also blow one up. It was during the Allied invasion where he played a real prominent role. And so he was able to really take advantage of that. But I think a lot of times people think, when they think of the military, they think of like just fighting, sure, fighting. And that's a huge aspect of it. But there's so many other departments. There's so many other areas where people can serve.
Yeah, there's a much bigger machine behind the front lines.
Yeah.
So that the front lines can exist.
Yeah. So how was it presented to you, of the opportunity of war correspondent? Or were you aware of it before you got into the Marine Corps?
I told myself I would talk to every recruiter, and I made the faithful decision of talking to the Marine Corps first. When it did my ASVAB, got my score, and I could have pursued other branches, but...
An ASVAB, for people that don't know, if you have a young person in your household and they want to consider the military, that's the first step that they have to take,
right,
to decide to enlist, enroll. They have to take the ASVAB test, which is basically, what kind of test is that?
It's an aptitude battery. It's a wide range of questions that you're tested on, that you have to... You're ranked against other people taking the same ASVAB at the same time against your peers, and you get a score. And then that score opens up different opportunities within the military.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't score very high, then maybe infantry is all that's available to you. But the higher you score, then now you're talking, you can be an intelligence, or, you know, a number of things. So
yeah, it creates plenty of opportunities. So you chose war correspondent.
I did my research and found combat correspondent. I thought, if I'm going to take pictures and tell tell a story, then that's where I want to be.
Yeah.
Because that's where everything was happening. That's where things were starting to kick off in March of 2003 during the initial invasion. And I had to wait months before I could go to basic training so that my position would open up. So I worked out and got myself ready for basic training, went off to boot camp in October of 2003. I remember getting the announcement there in San Diego within our platoon. They came out and they told us, hey, we got Saddam. We got him. We found him. We all start cheering. Yeah, all right, we got him. And they start yelling at us, shut up, shut up. You're still going to war. This ain't
right.
over.
Yeah.
He's still going. And finished basic training, earned the title of United States Marine. And then it was off to my schooling. And they trained me in journalism at the Defense Information School in Fort Meade, Maryland. And that was great. Those were like college years, going to class. And you're just responsible to learn and follow directions and stay fast. And after that was appointed to my duty station, which was in in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And that's where I worked for the base newspaper, The Globe, wrote for The Globe for about a year, doing training stories, which was great because everything that the Marine Corps was doing, I'd go be a part of that, which is why I say just my job. I think I had the best job in the Marine Corps. It was great. You get to show up with your camera and your job is to tell the Marine Corps story. So you get all that training, you take it back to your unit and tell those stories so that they can get, in hometown newspapers or, wherever people can learn about what's going on with those that we're involved in. So, if there's a concert or, somebody famous or there's a congressional delegation or, somebody, you're there to tell the story. So it was great. I loved it.
Wow. So that was in 2003 when you started that process and that journey. When were you first deployed to Iraq?
So my unit was deployed to Fallujah in 2005.
Okay.
Early 2005. This was February, March timeframe. Yeah.
Okay. So you were deployed in 2005. And so 2005 is really a year for you that was a game changer, if you will. So something happened on May 11th. Can you take us back to that date, May 11th, 2005, and maybe just kind of share with the audience what that day was like?
I remember that day vividly. I play it through my head almost every day. And I travel and I talk and I speak about having survived war and what that moment was like. And so I'm covering combat operations up near the Syrian border. We just crossed the Euphrates, one of the first, as I understand it, first combat river crossings since Vietnam. And so we crossed the Euphrates and we're sweeping north through these towns up to the Syrian border to kind of pinch off the insurgency. And at the time, we're on the heels of al-Zarqawi, who would later become known as the father of ISIS. So we're chasing him and his band out of the country. And we had some hard knocks. We went door to door, taking fire. We lose Marines. And I've got my camera out. I'm on rooftops, knocking down doors. I'm right there in the fight with the Marines that I was serving with in Lima Company 325 out of Ohio. And I basically finished my job. I had accumulated all this evidence. Now I'm going to get extracted and jump on a bird and fly back to my unit so that I can upload all of my footage, my pictures, my stand-ups, and get it on the evening news back to the States. So hours from extraction, I'm thinking to myself, let me get a little more B-roll while I've got the time. I'm heading out. Let me film my tape one more time.
What were you carrying? What kind of camera were you carrying?
I think it was a Sony S10, I think it was called. And no, I had a D10, D10. And I'm trying to remember the name of the video camera I had.
Things before an iPhone.
Correct. Yeah.
Because imagine if you had an iPhone, it would just be like pieces, you could shoot in 4K with this little device.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Which is why I didn't let the infantry guys give me any grief about not being infantry.
Right.
Because I was carrying everything they were carrying and more.
And more. Yeah. You had a gun and everything.
Yeah. Okay. In the Marine Corps, every Marine's a rifleman.
That's right.
So okay. we all train, we all carry rifles.
Okay.
So I had some buddies call me double shot because I had camera in one hand, rifle in the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm thinking, let me get some more B-roll. And I stand up in the vehicle that we were in, amphibious assault vehicle, large tracked vehicle, kind of looks like a big tank.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a troop carrier. So it's filled with Marines, chow and ammunition, everything you need to win the war. And I'm filming our movement through the terrain. And I'm thinking to myself, what a beautiful day it is. Blue skies, puffy clouds. And, next thing I know, boom, explosion. And there I was on the inside of the vehicle, got my orientation. It was like somebody had just turned their barbecue on top of me and just raining down hot coals as everything, all the debris started to fall back down inside the vehicle. And over my eyes, I had my goggles on, so I could see just flashes of orange, just fire right in front of my face. My first reaction was just a gasp, just so I inhaled fire and debris. And now panic sets in. I got to get out. So by then, one of the sergeants had muscled open the personnel hatch in the back of the track, and I just dove out. I landed in the road, and I looked at myself, and I'm on fire. So I start to roll and roll and roll. I'd stop, I'd look, I'm still on fire. And I basically exhausted myself trying to extinguish myself. And I thought, this is it. And this peace came over me, and I started to see, ironically enough, being a photographer, just, you know how they say your whole life flashes before your eyes? For me, it was just these pictures, just these still frames of the people in my life that meant the most to me. And I woke up to the sound of my fellow Marine yelling, "Put him out, put him out." And they run over and they dive on top of me and they're kicking dirt on top of me and they put out the fire and I kind of stand up. I'm not wounded from the waist down. I stand up and I'm thinking, where's my camera? I got to get my gear. I start walking back to the track that was now just ablaze, and everything inside started to cook off. All of our ammunition, all of our grenades, our flares, everything started to fire off. And it was about then, as I'm walking back to the track, that our Navy corpsman, Doc grabbed me by the collar and said, "Hey, you're hurt. You need to come with me." And that's really where the story of my recovery began. I was so hurt wandering around. I didn't know how hurt I was, that it took somebody else that had the training and the willingness and the availability to put themselves in that position to provide me with the care that I needed.
So you were kind of in a state of shock.
Of course, yeah. I mean, even on the stretcher, they've got me on the litter. They're carrying me to the helicopter to get me medevaced off the battlefield. And as they're running to the helicopter, sure enough, one of the guys rolls an ankle, bends a knee, and I just come tumbling out. Now I'm back on the ground. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not far. The bird's right there. I'll just walk. So I'm walking toward the bird. They start yelling at me, "Hey, hey, lay down, lay down, lay down. We got you. We got you. You're in shock." Like, I'm shocked that you dropped me.
Yeah.
Right? So I lay down. They get me loaded up. And from there to the aid station, they knock me out, get me on an Angel flight through Germany, back in San Antonio within 48 hours.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Our proficiency in battlefield medicine.
That's I think people don't realize that. You know, they can get you to Ramstein really fast from any theater of war, like almost overnight. And then from there, you were back in the United
States.
Just
to draw a comparison, just in Vietnam, if I had survived off the battlefield with these wounds, gone to another aid station, a surgical tent, and then to a Navy boat, the hospital ship in port, fill that up. That sails home, sits in port until there's room at the hospital. Then you can get a bed. Then you can see your family. That'd take about 48 days.
Yeah.
And I was back in 48 hours.
That's crazy.
So, and that results in, that proficiency results in survivors like myself that come home that this nation's never seen before.
Yeah. So how many of you were in that amphibious vehicle?
It was about 18 or so at the time. We had just stopped and let some people off. We had a Washington Post reporter that we were escorting. Oliver North's War Stories crew was around. But we had about 18 in the track at the time, six of which were KIA, and everyone else was wounded to some degree from smoke inhalation to I had a lieutenant in the back that bruised his backside really bad because he came down on his wallet. After the explosion. So,
and all these guys were from Lima Company?
Most were from Lima Company, yes.
Okay.
I was augmented from headquarters down to tell the story of Operation Matador, of all of the operations we were conducting.
Wow.
At that time.
Wow. So what was, you know, okay, so you're back in the United States in San Antonio within 48 hours of this event happening. And at that point in time, that was kind of the norm of how things would go with somebody with the severity of injuries that you had for the most part, right? I mean, if they were going to survive, then they had to get them back to the best place where you could get the best medical coverage and care.
Right. For the military, that's at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Fort Sam Houston. It's the home of the Institute of Surgical Research.
Okay. And so once you got back, when did you realize the severity of your injuries?
So I wake up in the ICU, strapped to a hospital bed. I had my arms up above my head, secured so that they wouldn't come down to my sides. I'd just gotten all these new skin grafts. Mm-hmm. And if my arms came down, they'd swell up and I'd need more surgery. So I wake up, I'm restrained. The first thing that hits me is the thirst. I've never felt thirst like this. It was all consuming. I couldn't focus on the pain or any other discomfort. All I could focus on was the thirst. And the only thing that made sense to me at the time, trying to realize where I was, is that I'd been captured. I was a POW. They're torturing me. And there's this bottle of water right off my reach is what it looked like to me in that state. But it was just my IV bag hanging there. And so as hospital staff would come in, I was usually ready to fight. I'm trying to get loose and get away until I had my wherewithal finally came in and they're telling me, do you know where you are? You're in San Antonio. And I'd pass out. Oh, okay. I'd wake back up. Do you know where you are? I guess I'm in San Diego. That makes sense for Marine to be in San Diego.
Sure.
No, you're in San Antonio. And realizing that I've been blown up. They sent me to Texas. I just roll my eye and pass back out. Like, I wake back up. Oh, but I'm not still in Texas. I'm still in Texas. And I was like, if this wasn't bad enough, now I'm stuck in Texas. So I let that go. And now I got to get out of the ICU, which means I got to sit up for a few hours a day. The next day I'd sit up longer, and that takes weeks. Now I can start walking. Now that I can stand up, I can walk a little bit. Okay. Now I'm worn out just walking down the hallway. Next day, walk a little farther, and just building on all of that to regain some independence, because I couldn't do anything on my own. Finally, it was well enough to get to the step-down unit where I did most of my recovery and time in the hospital. And that took weeks before I was prepared to undergo what the medical professionals call the mirror test. I covered all the mirrors in my room and on the way to the gym where we'd work out and recover.
That's all done on purpose.
It was, yeah, intentionally.
Okay.
I knew it was bad. And I knew looking at it wasn't going to change anything, make it better. I just wasn't ready to accept yet the gravity of my new reality until one day, you work up the courage and everyone comes by that moment on their own time. And I decided this is it. And so I, looked at myself for the first time and I just wept. I cried and cried. And, my nose was gone. My mouth had contracted to the point of, diameter of a dime. My mother had to feed me through a funnel for weeks. My ears were mostly gone, and I was just red. I didn't look human. And it wasn't until I took my arm and I covered my face, half my face, and I could see only my eyes, which were spared because of my goggles. And it looked more like me. I could see, there he is. There he is. And it was around that time I adopted the mantra of scars are not forever.
Yeah.
And to me, that meant that maybe the first thing you see or the first thing you notice when you encounter me for the first time, but if you just have a moment to hear me or to connect with me, then eventually that's the last thing you see or they fade away completely. So it's more of a just trying to adopt a positive mental attitude to that whole process, because I certainly had men and women that I was recovering with that wouldn't give you any leeway to have pity party or feeling bad for yourself. They were more than willing to help you accept the perspective of it's not that bad. It could be way worse.
Right. So. Right. Well, that's part of the military ethic though, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
In terms of just kind of, it's all about mindset. I think there is a tremendous value in the type of discipline and encouragement that comes in that space, right? Even in the face of adversity, you have to find encouragement. And I think that speaks volumes to what you experience. I'm curious to know how quickly from the time that you got back to San Antonio, was your family able to kind of be at your side? Or did you kind of feel alone at this moment?
Oh, no, I never felt alone. And again, I was here, stayed back in San Antonio 48 hours. I believe they were in San Antonio before that.
Okay.
They'd already received a phone call, I think, before Angel Flight left, before I left Germany. So they knew and had talked to the colonel, to the surgeon that was on the flight. We got him. He's he's good. We're bringing him home. And so they were aware the whole time. And as I began to wake up and this from this drug-induced coma, I thought I could hear my family, but I couldn't recognize them in the room. I couldn't see them. And to me, it was like, again, I was being tortured. I was being held captive. And they had my family, and they were there was some ransom that they had to pay before I could before they could see me. And it was like I was sitting in a theater on the very front row, and I couldn't get, you know, like I couldn't see over the orchestra pit, and I knew that they were back behind this curtain. I just couldn't see them or get to them, and I couldn't get away from my chair to connect with them until that eventually just faded away, and they were there. They were in my ear, and you know, they could see, you know, my heart monitor respond to family talking to me. So they knew I was with them.
Yeah. That must have been a special moment for sure. So even in spite of everything that was going on there, I know there's something about the familiarity of family that.
It was bittersweet, to be honest. Of course, that's the best medicine, having your family right there. So the sooner the better. But, you know, the reality is I volunteered. I raised my hand. I said, I'll go, send me. And I went to go fight. And then, boom, I come home early. I get taken out of the fight too early. And I wake up, and it was like my family was drafted.
Yeah.
Hey, you got to take care of this warrior.
Yeah. And
so, you know, the guilt associated with that, you know, stuck around for a while, feeling like I was now their responsibility because I was totally dependent on someone else for so long to do everything for me. So it's like their lives had to stop as well. And, but that went away fairly quickly, just in realizing that they love me and there's nowhere else that they'd want to be. And then after being wounded and starting my own family and now having two teenage kids, I know, you know, I'd be there in a heartbeat.
Like, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that everything that you've been through, you have built a level of resilience that most people would only dream of. So that goes without saying. Can you talk a little bit about the recovery process? I've seen different numbers, but I want to say at a minimum, you've had to have 60 plus surgeries.
Yeah, that's correct.
As part of your recovery process.
Yeah, I mean, the initial surgeries, you know, innovation, digging out all the junk from my lungs, skin grafts, a scar contracture releases, and then all the plastic surgery down the road to restore my humanity. And so, yeah, altogether, nearly 70. I've still got more on the books that I could do on my hand and my arm to increase functionality. But the recovery part of burns is one of the hardest things to survive,
yeah.
That you can endure as a human. In the burn gym, where we go to recover, we basically refer to it as torture with consent. Because you're just going to, the only way to fight scar contracture, scar tissue, is to pull on it, to fight it, to resist it. And it's incredibly excruciating when you've got open wounds in and throughout the affected area. And you do a surgery to, you know, maybe get some better movement in your arms. And then you're in the gym twice a day for hours, you know, trying to get stronger. And then, you know, you get a step ahead. You feel like you're making some progress. And then you need another surgery. And so you go in for that surgery and you take two steps back and you're off your feet again. Now you got to, you know, kind of feel like you're starting all over again, over and over. And so it can be demoralizing. It can be very defeating to feel like you're not making that progress. But like I said, you're surrounded by other individuals in the same situation that would just refuse to let you to feel sorry for yourself. You think you're having a bad day,
yeah.
Right? Let me show you what I got going on, right? Give you some perspective. You know, oh, well, at least I'm not as messed up as you are, right? This is great. You're right.
It's relative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
so did you, was that one of the greatest places of support that you found through the process is just by commiserating with others that
exactly.
have been through a lot of the same things you'd gone through?
Right. You didn't have to explain yourself. You didn't have to communicate anything. You could just walk in and sit there and everyone's in the same boat and you're all aiming for the same thing. You all want to try and be the best that you can be leaving that place. But yeah, the commiseration. So the burn gym, and it was also one of the funniest places I've ever been because it was just ruthless. It was just, again, any excuse they could have to pick on you or put you down or, you know, make you feel feelings, it was great. And that also simultaneously outside of that room, you were kind of like this sacred thing. You're a warrior. You're a wounded warrior. You're this. So people, they naturally have this reverence around you as you, as you're out in public or around others. They want to say thank you. They should say thank you. That's how I was raised. But it's just, you know, you're kind of put up on special. And so no one's going to make fun of you. And so to be around others that don't care about how special others think you are and just give it to you straight up was very refreshing. It was like, okay, you see me.
I can imagine. Did it ever get, and not that it would, I don't know if it's not that it would get old, but did you ever necessarily tire of just the constant showering people or just like, oh my God, you know, thank you so much for the sacrifice? And I mean, did you ever feel like that at all?
No, it's something I wouldn't say I get used to it. I've just accepted it. And that took some time as well. At first, it was just awkward. It was, you know, being thanked for my service. I wasn't used to that. You know, I'd served about 2.5 years in the fleet, you know, on active duty, and then spent about 2.5 years off my feet recovering. And that time, there's no booklet, there's no training, there's no guide. You just wake up, you're a war hero. So that was unsettling. But people would say, thank you. And I would, thank you. No, thank you. Yeah. Thanks. No, thank you. And it was just this thank you off. It was really uncomfortable.
Thank you off.
Yeah,
it's
really
like,
uncomfortable.
Who can out thank you? So.
And I had a buddy give me a little nugget that I took from him and his response. When someone would say, thank you for your service, he would say, thank you for your support. And I was like, that's so organic. Just, and it works. And so that's what I use every time and try and get other people involved in whatever veterans issues we're promoting at the time.
Yeah. You know what? I want to ask you this question because this is just on my mind now. I know sometimes you hear what can seem to be trite expressions of acknowledgement. And I know one of those that I've heard a lot, and I don't consider it trite because I totally understand and get the meaning. But you hear the expression, especially around Memorial Day, some gave all gave some, but some gave all, you know, meaning the ultimate sacrifice. And I'm thinking back to those six that were KIA that didn't have the chance to continue that story. Right. How does that sit with you? And, you know, what are your thoughts about that?
I feel like it's, you know, it makes me more thankful that I survived and that I'm here and that I have this life to live and this story to tell and that I'm the one here to tell it. And so it comes with a responsibility to continue to tell their story and to live a life that honors them, which is really just, you know, living the best life that I can. And those thank yous that I get, I accept on behalf of those that aren't here to hear it. And I know that it doesn't have to be me. I didn't, you know, it just happens to be me. So I'm happy to accept that, you know, that gratitude of a grateful nation, again, because it's the position I put myself in, and I'm still here to be a part of that story. So,
yeah. At what point in your recovery process did you go from, I don't know, not necessarily feeling like a victim, but at some point you were like, you know what, I have to turn this page. And I've got to take what I've been through and use it and benefit others in some way, shape, or form. Because I would imagine that, yeah, some of us could sit around and, you know, a lot of people would just say, hey, you know what, this is, woe is me, and I'm in a bad place because of what happened on May 11th. But you decided and said, no, that's not the story that I want to tell. What was for you the biggest factor in deciding that, you know what, I'm going to be very public and I'm going to get into a place where I can tell my story and feel comfortable about it?
I think I came by it just real naturally, just being there at the hospital. I didn't want to just lay around and be hurt. You know, I felt like I got taken out of the fight too early. I'd only been in country for about 3 months and wanted to do more. And I felt like if I did just lay around and I was bitter and angry and upset, like if anyone had that right, I felt like I did. I could feel those things. But I found that it was like being in a rocking chair. It gave me something to do, but it didn't get me anywhere. I wasn't accomplishing anything. And so I fell back on my training as a correspondent. And I made the hospital give me a position. They made me the patient media liaison. So anytime the media would come to do a story on Wounded Warriors, I'd show them around the hospital and get them their interviews or help out any way that I could, because I was trained to do that. And in doing so, wound up, you know, being interviewed in different formats, doing radio, doing TV, wound up on CNN with Lou Dobbs. And that particular piece caught the attention of a philanthropist in Los Angeles who he and his wife were inspired to start a program called Operation Mend out at UCLA Medical Center to focus on the plastic surgery needs, facial reconstruction of service members like myself who gave their humanity for their country. So to have just been doing what I felt came naturally, which was telling the Marine Corps story, has just launched into all these other opportunities from being consistent, from being present, and trying to communicate the needs of my new community of veterans. I felt like this is not only something that I can do well, but it's a way that I can stay engaged and continue to fight and give and serve in another capacity. So, you know, I've said before that I felt, especially early on, walking around in public, like I didn't get to take off my uniform because of the way that I looked. I wore my uniform everywhere I go. And so with that comes that realization of you're representing more than yourself. So you want to bring honor and respect to your core, to your brothers and sisters that you've served with.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, as I think about your journey and what you've been through, that's not always the journey that everybody experiences that has gone through something similar to what you've experienced. What would you say are some of the biggest challenges that veterans face today in terms of how can, you know, our community can better support veterans? And I know sometimes we hear stuff about the VA and other things, but what are some ways that the average individual can better support our veteran community?
That's a great question. I think listening to stories like this is one way to educate yourself. And that's the bottom line, is to be educated about the issues that veterans face. And so you got to do a little research, but that's just the bare bones, is to know what's going on in our community. The number one thing to show support is you got to give. You know, I gave. I served with those that gave. And so you pick a pony. Find an outlet. Find an avenue. Find an organization that supports the things in the veteran community that are important to you, that you're passionate about. You know, if you like ponies and equine therapy, there's an avenue for that. If you're more about mental health, there's an avenue for that. If it's physical surgeries and for amputees or something like that, there's an avenue for that. Or education or scholarships or home loans or you name it. There's an opportunity for everyone to be involved. And the fact that it's so skewed, we've got, 1% of the American population serves in the military, then if that other 99% if they all just did something, just gave something, then no veteran would ever need want for anything.
Yeah, and that's honestly, that's how it should be. And certainly
I think most of the public think that veterans are taken care of to a certain degree.
Right.
They've got it. Or that they just don't understand.
It's more than just a VA home loan and college tuition. So, right. I mean, because that's, I mean, when you think about it, you think that's that. But, I mean, there are other aspects too, right? I mean, there's the mental health aspect. There is just, you know, you hear stories all the time. And I try to stay alert to all the things that are happening. I have some family members that are in the military. And as I told you about my grandfather, but, you know, there is something to be said for giving of yourself to something greater than yourself.
Right. So if you're going to go up and you're going to shake a veteran's hand, you're going to say, thank you for your service. And that veteran says, thank you for your support. It'd be nice to be able to tell that veteran how you support vets.
Right.
And that's, you know, you got to get in the game.
Yeah.
It's got to cost you something, right? It's got to be a sacrifice. If it's going to be equivalent, right? If you're going to give, if you want to give the way that they gave and the spirit in which they gave, then it's got to cost you something. You got to do without. You got to go, I don't have this thing because I gave it up for this reason, so that I could show thanks, so that I could be grateful. And then, I mean, if we could accomplish that, like I said, the veteran community would be the most and best provided for community in the country. I have no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you share a story or a moment from one of your talks with students or veterans that really sticks with you? Something that just kind of encapsulates your experience?
I love having the opportunities to go and speak at schools or graduations or clubs. Or I've had a lot of great times in different places, you know, everywhere from the White House to the Playboy Mansion and in between. You know, I did have a moment backstage when I was introducing someone at a comedy show in New York City. And I think it was John Mayer was going to play, and I introduced John Mayer. But on the dais also that night, Robin Williams was doing a set, and he was there helping us raise money. And I did a little interview with Robin behind the scenes, and was hitting the craft table, hitting the snacks. And he came over to me, he walked up behind me, and he just talked to me just one-on-one for a second. And he just said, "Hey, are you okay? You doing all right?" And I was laughing, I was having a good time. But he was just checking in with me, because I think he knew that, you know, you can look happy and you can look like everything's great and you got the world together and still be struggling. And the fact that he took that time to check in on me always stuck with me. And it's one of those moments where I think, you know, that's what I need to be doing. You see somebody do something, you're like, that's the way I need to be doing it. And so checking in on people, making sure that they're doing okay. And, you know, that moment sticks out. At schools, I love schools because I'll do some Q&A and I'll give students a chance to ask some questions. And I remember I told them my story and I survived. And we talk about making choices and how you have the power to make one choice over and as an individual. Right now, you can make that choice of who you're going to be, regardless of what happens in your life, what bombs go off in your life. You can make that choice. And I opened it up for questions after that. I remember a first grader raised his hand and asked me probably one of the best questions I've ever been asked. His little voice just looked at me and said, "Do you like vegetables?" "I do. I do like vegetables. Thank you. Next question." It was great. I love that. What really matters? And I've done that before, like in a grocery line, or, you know, talking to kids, because you can have fun with it too, right?
Sure,
like,
sure.
I'll explain to them, "I look this way because I didn't eat my vegetables."
Right.
And they get all wide-eyed. Oh, man. Oh man.
Pass me the broccoli, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
But, you know, so many great opportunities. Well, I'll share one story with you. There I was at the Playboy Mansion doing another fundraiser for Operation Mend in conjunction with the Thalians. And they're like big Hollywood talent and agents. They've, you know, been doing this for like 55 years, raising money for different organizations. And this year it was Operation Mend. And Hugh Hefner's there. He's getting the award as Mr. Wonderful. And there's comedians and musicians. I think Slash was there, Sugar Ray, and some other folks. So it's a big show, big party in the backyard, in this big tent. And just a lot of old Hollywood in the room, hundreds of people. And it comes a time for like the program. They're going to show a video of Operation Mend, and it's powerful. I encourage your listeners.
Is that on YouTube?
I don't know that moment's on YouTube.
Well, I'd find something from Operation Mend and see if I can put that on the show notes.
Yeah, so great. Yeah. Yes, Operation Mend videos. Yes, that is on YouTube or on the website. And it's powerful because you just see the life come back in the eyes, see the spirit come back in the eyes of people that have been through the program. And so it's a powerful video. The whole room's feeling it's a little somber. And so I jump up and I'm just going to say thank you to everyone for coming, and what you do tonight, it makes a difference, and the impact it's going to have, not just on my life, but on the life of the men and women that we all call heroes. And I turned to Hef, and I want to thank Hef for letting a few Marines come out and have our way at the bar. We're having a great time. Really appreciate, man, how comfortable I find myself here in this place. And I can only assume it has something to do with being surrounded by so many people that have had as much plastic surgery as I've had. And the crowd erupts, standing ovation, biggest laugh of the night. I didn't know what to do. I was, sure. You know, thank you and good night. I just dropped the mic. I was out.
That was it. Yeah. Sometimes you got to leave on a high note.
I'm out. Yeah, I'll see
you. So I love that. I love that. I like the way you referred to Hugh Hefner as Hef. So that's cool. So clearly you had some relationship with him. I think that's awesome. So, yeah, I want to talk real quickly. I know there's a couple of things before we wind up. Life continued for you. I mean, you have a family, you have kids, teenage kids at this point in time. How have your experiences shaped the way that you raise your teenagers? And what values do you hope they take away from your journey?
Another great question, Randy. Thank you. You know, I think having become a father shortly after I was wounded and still, you know, I was blown up at 23. I had my daughter at 25 and then my son at 27. And shortly after that, you know, I was a single dad for the rest of their lives, basically. And so to raise them with the perspective that I have of what's important, what matters here, and what generally matters the most is being proud of yourself and how you handle the situation. If you need to walk away, walk away. I never gave them any leeway on not getting along with one another. Like, we're a family. If there's something we got to work out, let's work it out.
Yeah.
But we're not going to, you know, have any sibling nonsense, rivalry stuff. So,
yeah.
And making sure that, you know, the oldest one knew you're going to love having this guy around. Right. And vice versa. Like, you guys are going to be best friends if you allow it. So that perspective of, you know, this is what matters. This is what's important. Those kind of things. So, and not to let other people get to you. You have that power. You make that choice if somebody's going to upset you or not. And to see them grow into just smart, funny, amazing people that they are today, I couldn't be more proud of who they've become. And I know that they look at me as I'm the only example in the house of, you know, what's important. And it's those relationships that you build along the way, you know, and to hear my kids tell me as much, they're proud of me because basically everywhere I go, people are happy to see me.
Yeah.
And that means the world to me.
That's awesome. What are your hopes for the future in terms of both your family, both those, your kids and your advocacy work?
Well, for my kids, I hope that, you know, in the future, they're happy and successful and have everything they need and only rely on me for counsel. But still call and still check in and want to know how I'm doing. So I just wish them success. As far as my veteran advocacy work, it'd be nice to be out of a job and not need to do that anymore. I see John Stewart out there advocating for veterans because he can get the mics and the cameras and the attention and for the land. If it weren't for some of the work that he's done, we wouldn't have the traction that we have, you know, like in the PACT Act and having addressed burn pits in country, which has kind of become our nation's.
Stewart's done it on multiple levels with 9/11 victims. Oh, I mean, you name it. I mean, everybody.
Yeah, just great work. And so, but there's behind him are, you know, so many veterans that work day in, day out on legislative initiatives. And I've had the benefit of working with IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and their initiatives throughout the years to bring substantive change to our community. It's been incredibly rewarding. So my hope is that I could just keep having opportunities to tell my story. I feel like that's why I'm here. And so everything I've done so far, I'm not big on social media. I'm not really trying to push myself out there in any, you know, meaningful way other than just word of mouth. So if I can go somewhere and say a bunch of words in a row and leave an impact on somebody who goes by and tells somebody else, and that's how I wound up in your chair today. So I rely on that. So just keep getting the word out and keep doing what I do. And I'll do that for a while.
I love that. All right. So finally, as we wrap this up, and I know there are a lot of other things that we could talk about. I mean, you were given a free home based on, you want to share that real quickly? Just give us the Cliff Note version of that story.
Oh, it was great. I was approached by Bobby Bones, the Bobby Bones Show, to do an interview. And I thought he was going to put it in the can, save it for, you know, Veterans Day or Memorial Day. And toward the end of the interview, he said, you know, we're going to give you a house. And they started fundraising, selling gear. And I get stopped at Walmart from buddies wondering, hey, you got this shirt for you, man. And they built a house here in Rogers. And my kids and I moved into it last December. So almost been there a year now and we're settled in. And it's just the greatest. It's exactly what we needed. And there's nothing, again, to prepare you for that, that people want to say thank you. And that manifests itself in a multitude of ways. If it's, you know, a new house or a handshake or buying you a beer or fixing your face,
every little bit helps.
I've just been incredibly blessed. So,
well, you've given so much. I mean, and so, I mean, it's, I'm thankful. When I heard that story, when I read that, I was like, wow, that's really cool that to be able to receive that. And let's be clear, not every veteran gets that kind of treatment. And so that's why you're out there continuing to beat the pavement and letting people know that there's still so many out there.
That's right.
That maybe have no outward appearance of having been through a war or having served in the military, but are still struggling.
Yeah.
And we need to acknowledge them as well. So, you know, I mean, it goes without saying. Finally, what message do you most want to share with the community, especially those who might feel disconnected from the challenges veterans face? Because I'll be honest with you. I mean, of course, we know these stories. You hear about them. You know, you every now and then you hear about the person of the week on ABC News or something like that, where that's a veteran that has been through a major challenge. But what message do you want to most share with the community? If there was one thing that you would just share early and often with people about, especially for the challenges that veterans face, what would it be?
I'd say, you know, to get involved, to find an avenue that keeps you busy in some kind of veteran organization. You know, here locally, we've got Sheepdog Impact Assistance.
I'm yeah.
on the board of directors for them. We've got a team going out to help.
North Carolina.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hurricane Helene. We've got a crew going out there now. You know, but the one thing I'd like to leave, I guess, you know, with the community or have them at least contemplate, something to think about, you know, because we love our military so much, you know, and every game day and we find flags and this patriotism that we see on constant display. And I just think it's a shame that, you know, when service members separate from active duty and become a veteran and go back into our communities, that part of that transition, you're basically told like to not be as military anymore. You're like, you need to reassimilate. You need to, you know, don't say things like this. Don't use military jargon. Don't knife hand people. Don't, you know, and you're expected to kind of take all this training and all this experience that you have that is so effective and
turn it off
and turn it off, when I think just the opposite should take place. And that when you go, you know, into a new workplace, you bring that professionalism, that leadership into those environments, and that could be incredibly beneficial for the civilian population.
There's a thing to be said for military precision.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that's lost. And I'm glad you said that. And, you know, it's so funny because I'm kind of at a place now with my sons where, you know, one is thinking about getting into the military. And I said, well, you know, I think it would fine tune him. Right. I mean, and I think it would give him some additional things that is, it's not that I couldn't give him as a parent, but sometimes you need other people to speak into the lives, especially of young people, that just has a profound effect. And I'm sure that happened to you when you enrolled in the Marine Corps. And even before May 11th, 2005, yeah. It kind of set you up for a level of success that even after that unfortunate incident, you were prepared to deal with something like that. Even though technically we would think, oh, that's impossible. But the Marine Corps prepared you. That's why they talk about the refining fire of the mm-hmm. Marine Corps. And that it's not an accident that was the branch of military service that you went through. And it ultimately set you up for a level of success that I don't think you probably would have ever dreamed you would have had to utilize the way that you have.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's the truth. Because in the Marines, you have that pride that we're going to do the hardest thing. We're going to make it through. We're going to get to the other side. You wouldn't do it if you didn't have that faith. And that's what courage takes. It takes two things. It takes fear. You got to be scared. You got to be afraid. If you're not afraid, you don't know what's going on.
Yep.
You're probably an idiot. So you got to be afraid. Then you have to have faith, and you have to believe that if I move forward, things are going to work out the way they're supposed to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, they definitely are doing that for you, my friend. And I want to thank you, Aaron, for taking time to come on the podcast today and share your story. And I think this is a special Veterans Day story, something that I want to share over and over again with our audience, because it won't get old. It only gets better as you continue to tell this story and as you continue to go out and make a difference in the communities that you're serving. And so I want to personally thank you for your service and your continued service to our communities, both here locally in Northwest Arkansas and anywhere that you go and place your foot. I just would just wish you nothing but continued success in everything that you do.
Thank you, Randy.
Absolutely. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, is there a website or anything that we would point them towards? Or
I have some social media out there. I'm not very active on it. Like I said, I usually do word of mouth stuff. I do have there's a Facebook. You can message me on Facebook if you want to leave a message. I check that. every other month or so.
Okay.
I'm busy with my kids and living my life.
That's it. That's how it should be.
I'm always looking for opportunities to share my story and get it out there. I just feel like, you know, and part of it, that message is just to take care of the veterans we got before we start making new ones.
Absolutely. And I have your dad's email, so I'll make sure we figure out a way to possibly share that out
Pops
there.
Yeah, Pops knows how to get a hold of me.
Yes. Yeah, the indomitable Steve Mankin. And so I appreciate just the ability to connect with him as well. And again, I want to thank Karen for introducing us. And now that we're friends, you can't get rid of me now. Awesome. So I just want to let you know. So we're connected.
Great. And what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
Yeah. So we'll figure something out. I will be here in Northwest Arkansas. That's for sure. So we'll have to do something else together for sure. But I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to come and meet with me and to tell your story here on the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. So again, from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate you and everything about you, and just keep doing what you're doing. I just want to encourage you to keep telling your story because people need to hear it.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.
Absolutely. Well, there you have it, folks. Another episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. It was a little longer. It was almost like Joe Rogan-ish, right? I mean, it was a long episode, but it was a very important episode. And so I hope you enjoy that. To learn more about us or to read or download the show notes from today's episode, visit IamNorthwestArkansas.com. You can listen to this podcast and sign up for our free newsletter to sign up to keep up with us and all things NWA, please consider signing up today. You can also subscribe or follow the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast wherever you listen to it. And please consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. Remember, our podcast comes out every Monday, rain or shine. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn, and we'll see you back here next week for another new episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. Peace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. Check us out each and every week, available anywhere that great podcasts can be found. For show notes or more information on becoming a guest, visit IamNorthwestArkansas.com. We'll see you next week on I Am Northwest Arkansas.